Honor, it's Gary Dukoff on behalf of Appellant Blitz. I'd like to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal. So first let me say I'm very grateful for being afforded an oral argument in a case touched by the icy cold fingers of the AEDPA. I know I've had to overcome a lot of hurdles to get to even this point, and hopefully I can use these last few minutes to overcome any other hurdles that might still be in front of me. The case raises a question of procedural due process, and the only thing we're asking for is fair process in the answering of that question.
Help me on something here.
Sure.
If you prevailed, the defendant would not be paroled as far as I can see. He'd get a new parole hearing in front of an unbiased tribunal, assuming that your claim of bias is satisfactorily established. Is that right?
So now that's absolutely correct. I was just going to make that very point, but I don't
know. The question that raises for me is, did he already get that? Did he get a subsequent parole hearing without Ferguson on the presiding at the hearing?
Right. Yes, he did. That's the Attorney General, the California Attorney General's argument as to why the case is moved. And I responded to that in my reply.
They want some help orally. Why? He hasn't already gotten what he seeks.
Well, number one, we have no idea whether he in fact got another hearing in front of an impartial panel. We know Ferguson wasn't on it, but as I said in my brief, that's not the definition of a constitutional controversy, and there's nothing in the record.
Well, we wouldn't supervise the panel. All we'd do is issue something saying, well, another parole hearing for this fellow, this first one wasn't fair. But I don't know what we could do that hasn't already been done.
Well, this court wouldn't even order a parole hearing if it ruled in my favor. The only thing I'm asking for is if you remanded to the district court so that I could have the evidentiary hearing to prove my claim. And the district court could order a subsequent parole consideration hearing in front of an impartial panel, and they can maintain jurisdiction to review the...
Why is there any reason to think that he has not already had a subsequent parole hearing before an impartial panel?
Well, my point is we don't know anything about the impartiality.
So, ordinarily, you presume that things are done in accord with law.
Well, they weren't done. It looks like they weren't done in accordance with law in this case.
And on the Ferguson hearing, but on the second one, all we have to go on, since we know nothing, is the usual presumption.
Right, so what I said in my briefs is the burden of proving mootness is on the California Attorney General, and it's a heavy burden, and when the record is silent about the impartiality of the intervening...
So you're saying that if we know nothing, we should assume that all parole board hearings are tainted by partiality or interest until proven otherwise?
No, I'm not saying that. I don't believe this assumption is necessary to grant the relief that I'm asking for.
I think it is, as you've argued it, and that's why I'm giving you a chance to educate me so that I can correct it.
Well, first of all, I've cited, 10 to 15 district court cases that have ruled, as I'm urging this court to rule, that an intervening parole hearing, which they knew nothing about, did not render the court moot. The other side has not come up with a single case that ruled in the opposite direction.
Do you have any circuit court authority? I mean, a lot of your authority is no authority at all. It's unpublished district court cases.
Well, some of them are published district court cases, one of which was from Judge Nguyen of this court, and then I cited an unpublished Ninth Circuit case, and that's what's out there, so it's not like...
You have no circuit court authority that goes your way.
Except for the unpublished decision from this court that comes
out. No rules on that, but we're not bound by that.
It's persuasive authority I've presented it as.
You don't have enough factual explanation and legal explanation to make them useful for us. That's why we don't see it.
Right, but it's clear on the face of that unpublished Ninth Circuit decision that they did not find the intervening parole hearing to have rendered the case moot. And the test, it seems to me, is satisfied in the circumstances of this case. I've alleged an actual injury suffered by the petitioner. It's traceable to the California Parole Board, and this court can order a remedy for the district court.
Counsel, this case even sounded habeas.
Right.
Called clearly, and that's the only avenue of relief here is a Section 1983 claim.
And so I can't argue with this court about told when I was getting ready for this argument, Judge Wardlaw, that you were on the panel that was reversed by Swarthout versus Cook. And Judge Kleinfeld wrote the majority on bank opinion in Hayward versus Marshall that was overruled by Swarthout versus Cook. And it turns out that it's Swarthout that I believe provides the definitive answer to that question. In the overruling and in the overturning, the court said that the federal due process clause provides minimal procedural protections.
But those protections are extraordinarily minimal. But what we said in Nettles is that when your client was not going to be immediately released, was not going to affect his custodial status, but rather his condition of the confinement, which sounds like a moral hearing, which means that you need to file a 1983 complaint. If we already decided that it wasn't due, could we remand and have you attend the stage of 1983 claim under Nettles?
I believe it would be very difficult for me to bring a viable 1983 claim at this late date. But let me just read to the court.
I don't understand why you're not just stuck with 1983 viable or not viable under Nettles.
Right, because Nettles can't overrule the statement or holding of the Supreme Court.
And we're bound by Ninth Circuit authority unless an intervening Supreme Court case is clearly irreconcilable with it.
All right, but the Nettles court developed that rule in addressing a claim that the petitioner was denied due process at a prison disciplinary hearing. I presented to the court the lone district court case that's discussed in the very context that I'm talking about, which is the claim of a biased adjudicator. And
Swarthout came first, Nettles came second. What that means is we would have to say Nettles is wrong under Swarthout to go your way. We're bound by Nettles.
But I'm not quite sure that's true, because Swarthout said, I see what argument you're trying to make now. You're saying that this doesn't meet the minimal, because there was a biased adjudicator, it fails to even meet the minimal due process protections that the Supreme Court set out to Swarthout. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. But isn't that, given that he's not going to be immediately released, how does that change Nettles' requirement that he bring that claim as a 1983 claim?
If the court decides that Nettles controls, obviously I can't meet that test. I concede that the relief we're seeking will not be immediate or speedy.
I know, but I don't know why you're conceding or that you couldn't bring a 1983 claim.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen if the court sends it back with instructions to allow me to amend it or to do something to bring a 1983 claim. I don't know if I'm going to be successful. I raised the point about
the constitutional right would be the bare minimal procedural safeguards of Swarthout. Wouldn't that be the clear constitutional right?
Yes, but I just want to make the point that Swarthout says this. With respect to examining the minimal due process protections that the due process clause provides, that should have been the beginning and the end of the federal habeas court's inquiry. The Supreme Court, like every federal court, has a sua sponte obligation to question subject matter jurisdiction of the case before it. That was a habeas case. They had an obligation to say they had no jurisdiction, and they said not only did they not question their subject matter jurisdiction, but they say that's within the inquiry that federal habeas courts can make. So the fact that Nettles, in a different factual context, comes up with this test, Swarthout seems more on point, and it seems to me the court is just as bound by Swarthout as it is by Nettles, if not more so. So I'll reserve the 40 seconds I have. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Deputy Attorney General Brian Kinney, appearing on behalf of the respondent. This court should dismiss Mr. Woods' appeal for two reasons. First, Mr. Woods' 2012 bias claim became moot when he received a new parole hearing in 2015 in front of a different panel. And second, Mr. Woods' bias claim, even if he is successful, does not establish federal habeas jurisdiction because the justice he received is a new hearing.
Appellant's argument is that he might get yet another parole hearing before another board, and you never know what's going to happen, even if he wasn't scheduled for another parole hearing. Why wouldn't that defeat mootness?
Mr. Woods didn't receive already another parole hearing.
But he did get another.
And there's been no allegation that that bail was improper, biased, or a bias against Mr. Woods. There's a presumption that all adjudicators proceed with honesty and integrity.
Right, but we know, or we have evidence or allegations that makes it as of 2012 to proceed with an unbiased adjudicator.
All right, if we assume Mr. Woods can establish an HIPAA violation, and then that also that these factual allegations were correct, even then, if this one particular instance that there was a biased adjudicator and does not show Mr. Woods' burden, that there's a reasonable expectation that this will happen again. This is a one-time thing if it did happen, and he's put no evidence in the record to suggest that we could have these ways to suspect that this would occur again with regards to bias against Mr. Woods.
So tell us under your theory, doesn't save you unless they will, as long as every other hearing is enforced with due process, we're okay.
No, Your Honor, I mean, the claim in this particular case is very specific about pecuniary interests or a pending job application on the part of one commissioner who no longer works.
I understand your argument that with the 2015 hearing mooted all the potential claims. My question is, if some person discovered that they had a hearing in 2010, which they were entitled to before a biased panel, but in 13 they got a hearing for an unbiased panel, and in 15 they have a new claim that was biased. At some point, the state has to show that the procedures produce unbiased panels. Otherwise, you say, well, as long as they do it once in a while, we're okay. We mooted all the procedural defects of the earlier hearings.
Correct, Your Honor, but once it's been established that he did receive a new hearing, the claim is moot, and then Mr. Woods has to proceed under an exception to the mootness requirement. And the exception required is upon his burden to prove that there is a reasonable expectation that we could think that this same injury, a biased adjudicator with a pending job application with the district attorney's office is going to appear, is likely to happen to Mr. Woods, and specific to Mr. Woods, the same claim party. Now, even if we assume that this potentially could happen at some future date to some prisoner, that is not sufficient to meet the burden Mr. Woods has with regard to mootness and the exception that he invokes.
Is it right that Ferguson could no longer sit and did no longer sit at a second hearing because he's with a different agency now? He's with the AG's or DA's officers.
That's correct, Your Honor. At the time when the petition was filed in the state court, he was already at the district attorney's office. I'm not aware where he is now, but he's no longer with the board.
How do you respond to his claim under Sport Out that this procedure with the biased, allegedly biased hearing officer doesn't carry any minimal deterrence of the due process clause as outlined in Sport Out by the Supreme Court?
From what I understand, is Mr. Delkoff's making the argument that Sport Out v. Cook implicitly endorsed habeas challenges against parole decisions. Sport Out v. Cook did not address the specific issue of whether or not it's properly brought in habeas. Moreover, Sport Out v. Cook was with regard to a parole decision and challenging the actual result of that decision, challenged some evidence standard of review. Here, Mr. Woods is not challenging the actual decision, he's challenging the partiality of the panel. And that is obviously a procedural flaw that would entitle to a new hearing, not the same type of remedy he would get if he could establish that the decision of the parole panel was wrong. Unless this court has any further questions.
Further questions?
Yeah. Thank
statement of this from the Carrick Tribe of California that was made by this court, in which the court said the Susina case is moved in the late stages of appeal is justified only when it is absolutely clear that the litigant no longer has any need of the judicial protection that he sought. So there's absolutely, the burden is not on me to prove that, that Mr. Woods will always get an impartial parole hearing.